Hello, and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast. This is Fred Heldenfels, Chairman of the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board. And now, here's your host in all his youthful and boyish charm, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the third week of July. Joining me is reporter Jay Root.
Hello.
Trying to decide who to pick first there. I don't know if you heard that hesitation. We also have managing editor Brandy Grissom.
Hello.
So there was some hesitation, too. She didn't know
I wasn't
what
sure when to say hello to you.
And Jim Henson from the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.
Hi, Reeve.
Is also here.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
There's been a lot going on in the last couple of days in the political world. A lot of confusion, I think, especially around this issue of whether or not Rick Perry called on Mitt Romney or did not call on Mitt Romney to release his tax returns. So I think what we're going to do before we talk about that is listen to what Rick Perry actually said when he was asked about this yesterday, yesterday being Tuesday, July, whatever.
Yesterday. I'm a big believer that no matter who you are or what office you're running for, you should be as transparent as you can be with your tax returns and other aspects of your life so that people have the appropriate ability to judge your background and what have you. I certainly think it is inappropriate for the President of the United States to not keep his college transcript and his law school transcripts public. He should make those available. So I'm all about transparency.
So, Jay, you were there. What do you think he was saying?
Well,
because I believe the AP initially reported that he called on Romney to release his tax returns, and so did the Dallas Morning News.
Well, he was saying that people should be transparent in general, but I really was kind of lying in wait there for him, you know, laying in wait, whatever. I always get mixed up with that. But I really wanted to pin him down on that. Did he think that Mitt Romney needed to cough up more tax returns in the same way that he had in 2010 demanded that Bill White produce 15 years of tax returns or else, you know, I'm not going to debate you. That's what happened in 2010. And he just didn't go all the way. That period. He just did not. I gave him two opportunities to say whether or not he thought Mitt Romney should to give more than what he has promised to give, and he wouldn't do it.
But, so you wanted to pin him down, but he didn't go all the way, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, just to clarify.
I can see the way this podcast is going.
It's going to be a very blue podcast. Yeah. You can already tell. But how come it was reported differently by different people, though? We had this. So for those of you who don't know about the Trib Wire feature on the Tribune's website, which is really the only thing I read, we just have links to different stories sort of as they come in and people think they're interesting. Our reporters and editors put them up there. Instantly after this quote, there was one story that said Perry refuses to call on Romney to release tax returns. And just above that it said Perry calls on Romney to release tax returns. Did he mean to leave it ambiguous like that? You know, was it sort of read into it what you want?
No, I think that Perry was mindful of his own history with tax returns, mindful of the fact that he, 2 days before Rick Perry pulled out of the presidential race in South Carolina, he said, you know, we got to have your tax returns now. We can't wait till September or October. So I think he was mindful of all that. And in fairness to Perry, he has been very open about his own tax returns. We have his tax returns going back to 1987. But I think that he also was very careful not to press Romney. I mean, Rick Perry has endorsed Mitt Romney. He wants to leave that up to Boston. You know, they can decide that in Boston about what they're going to do. He did not want to be one of those people that's named as, oh, another governor. I think that they very specifically wanted to avoid that.
But why say anything? I mean, I was a little puzzled by the whole thing, frankly.
Because he was asked about it.
You know, I mean, why not just say that's not up to us? I mean, it felt a little to me like he needed to stop talking and didn't.
Or was it because he wanted to make the point about Obama releasing his transcripts?
Well, that's a very good point, too. He also threw in that thing about Obama, that he needed to release his college transcripts. And in fact, when I came back the second time around, with Rick Perry, you really have to ask follow-ups because he is very good at giving the talking points. And in order to get something specific, you have to ask a follow-up. So in the follow-up, when I asked him, I said, so you think he should release more then? And he said, yes, I do think the president should release his college transcripts. So, and he knew what I was talking about. I mean, he, you know, but then...
You're
then
a hard guy to read sometimes, Jay.
He came back to it. He came back to it, but he just didn't... He did not call on Mitt Romney, I don't think, to release more tax returns.
Are those the same thing, tax returns and your college transcript? Obviously, literally, they're not the same thing.
Mine are definitely not. There's more of one than the other. They're not the same thing, and it all sounds very muddled to me. And it sounds, frankly, I mean, to me, it's frankly kind of botched. I mean, because
on Perry's part,
yeah, because it didn't feed into the narrative. You know, nobody really carried. You know, Rick Perry's. You know, renews calls for Obama transcripts. It was all. Rick Perry joins chorus of Republicans discussing Romney transcripts. If you look at the broad coverage of what's going on with the presidential campaign, that's what happened. I mean, there's little doubt in my mind that there was anybody in Romney campaign headquarters going, ah, Rick Perry really did us a solid yesterday. It's not happening that way. So we can parse it out a lot. From 30,000 feet, it seems...
Do you think the Obama campaign is like, oh man, we've got to get those transcripts now?
Yeah, no, I think the Obama campaign is frankly saying we love Rick Perry.
That's why Obama came to Austin yesterday.
I think that and I know you're probably trying to segue.
I'm not at all.
Oh, you're not?
No.
Into Obama?
No, we have 10 more minutes of this.
Oh, do we?
Yeah. So okay. You better talk slow.
But we can segue English. Into Obama. That's actually worth maybe talking about a little bit.
Okay, well, say whatever you want, and then we'll segue.
Well, I was just going to say that college transcripts really are not the same thing as tax returns. I mean... There hasn't been this expectation that presidential candidates release college transcripts. That's not something that has really fed in. Now, they have been released. You know, Bush's came out in 1999.
Coming out is not the same thing as being released, is it? Okay, that's also not, you know.
Yeah. What you meant to say was, would you like me to clean that up for you? All you meant is that, you know,
being leaked. They can be
leaked. Transcripts might have been leaked. Right.
Right. But well, then that's a very good point. They weren't, they didn't, he didn't provide them. They just came out. So somebody leaked them.
Perry wasn't like, you know, I would like to now
no, exactly.
give the media my D
right.
in meat biology.
That's the other thing is that Perry didn't voluntarily show his grades from A&M, which were not good. They were pretty bad, actually.
I honestly think every second we're talking about college transcripts, we're suckers. I mean, I just think it's a non-issue.
So what do you want to say about tax returns?
I mean, it was just a
no, but I mean, tax returns
have become...
Is
tax returns a real issue?
Well, tax returns have become a sort of something that candidates release, even though they're not required. There is no requirement in the law that tax returns be released. Maybe there should be, but there's not. And I thought it was interesting that Perry said yesterday that all candidates basically should release their tax returns, and he didn't
to the extent that they can.
Well, that's a good point. But he didn't say how much. He didn't put any quantifier on it. But I thought it was interesting that he didn't say presidential candidates because obviously are you know, the Tribune is asking other candidates lower down the food chain. And I don't think that the tax returns, I mean, I think that the tax returns are a good way of finding out where people make their money. It's a very good window, and because it's something that you sign your name onto, you promise it. And I think that it would be kind of a good reform in a way to require that.
And particularly in this campaign where how much money he makes is just, and how he spends it and how much taxes he pays are clearly a huge issue.
Where he keeps it.
And where he keeps it.
And obviously Obama thinks it's a winning issue for him because they've just been hammering Romney over the head with it. Well, and that is our segue to Obama's visit to Austin.
Well, I mean, it fits in the, and it doesn't have to be a segue completely into Obama. I mean, for one,
I just made it.
As far as that point goes, it fits into the frame the Obama campaign is building around Mitt Romney, that, you know, he's different than average people and that he's hiding stuff and that you don't know who he is. So all that is pretty clear. I mean, you can still tie it to the governor as well. I mean, the governor also, you know, got some press yesterday for at least a few hours. I don't think it had a pretty short half-life, by welcoming the president to Austin by saying that he should, you know, apologize, I guess, for Eric Holder's comparison of the voter ID bill to the poll tax when Holder spoke at the NAACP. Now, I think if you take that and this college transcript thing, I mean, it puts this whole issue of, was he talking about transparency or non-transparency in a different context, right? Which is, you know, it was kind of a day of standing up, being a Republican, and trying in one way or the other to poke the Obama campaign in the eye and be a good Republican. So, I mean, I think...
Do you think that was that news flurry as botched as the transcript tax return one?
I don't think it was as muddled, but I don't think it was received as much other than what it was. I mean, and you know, it was probably a little bit more successful in the sense that the Perry campaign people know that, you know, how voter ID polls, how it plays to middle of the road voters, and even to some, you know, relatively, you know, less partisan Democrats. I mean, you know, waving your hands around voter ID, as we know from the polling we've done, voter ID polls well if you ask people about it, but if you ask people if it's a problem, it doesn't move the needle at all. And people also, you know, there's a big chunk of people that actually think you already have to show a voter ID even prior to the passage of the law. So that's all very muddled, and it's kind of easy point scoring.
Well, and then Obama came in and set some fundraising records during his visit here, so it appears to have... Yeah. Had the desired effect, I guess.
Yeah, what does he care? Yeah.
Well, I thought it was just interesting, too, that Perry held a press conference. He hasn't done that in a really long time. I mean, and this had the feel of almost of a full-blown press conference. I mean, it didn't last very long, but, like, we went into the speaker's committee room, and everybody went and sat down. It wasn't – they had sort of billed it as an avail, you know, very quick. There was a little event going on in the House chamber. And he would just take us aside and, you know, would talk about Obama's visit. But it was a little more open than that. And just, you know, it illustrates a little bit that, you know, why do you do it now? Well, because this fits into the narrative that Perry has really just, you know, jumped on and has never let go of, which is this anti-federal government thing. And, you know, he never passes up an opportunity to talk about that, and that's nearly all of his national, you know, appearances on television or whatever are geared toward that narrative.
Right, it's part of his leadership of Newt Gingrich's 10th Amendment initiative. When he got out, that's what Gingrich, and he endorsed Gingrich. Remember, Gingrich said, right, you know, I'm going to award Rick Perry. He'll be the head of a very important task force on the 10th Amendment.
So that task force lives on
in somebody's mind.
Yeah. Do you think was this the beginning of his 2016 campaign? This press conference.
You know, actually, today, Wednesday.
Is that a yes?
Today, Wednesday.
That's a botched response.
Today, Wednesday, yes, the 18th. No? Reeve, for counting dates here.
You're obviously. Perry
said that he had, quote, "I have no idea," end quote, "I'm going to run for re-election in 2014," which I think, if he's going to run for president, I think it probably – a lot of people think that he will run first for governor because he needs to be governor to have the base that, you know, fundraising and other things that allow you to run for president or help you run for president later. So I thought that was interesting that he said that today, because normally he says, you know, you should count on that. I'll make my decision later. But it seemed slightly different to me today.
And that was, you were at his mansion.
We're at the mansion today.
Right? And how does the mansion look?
The mansion looks really great. It's really, Perry said that it was eerie to walk back in there because it looks
the same.
Because
it's so much nicer than it was before.
No, it looks the same. It really does. It is kind of eerie. I mean, walking in there, it was just like everything, you know, all of the furnishings, the paintings, the portrait of Sam Houston, all of that, it's all been put back where it was. All of that stuff was not in the mansion when it burned. And so much of the mansion was saved. I mean, the roof and the a lot of the railings were gone, but the columns were saved. The flooring was saved. All of the furnishings. Sam Houston's bed. It's a good story in a time when there's not a whole lot of good stories.
Is it going to be a reduction in his lifestyle from where he's been living?
Well, they added 1,500 square feet of living space to the residence, to the private residence part of it. But yes, he is going to experience a reduction in amenities and space. I mean, it is smaller than the rental mansion was, which was about $9,000 a month.
Doesn't it also have fewer pools?
There is no pool at the governor's mansion.
I think that was her point.
Yeah.
Have they restored?
Yes.
Have they restored functionality and power to the many security cameras that weren't operating at the time it was engulfed in flames?
There's significant security upgrades, but I can't talk about them.
All right, and of course, none of this stuff was discussed at the U.S. Senate debate on Tuesday.
There was no mention of the mansion that I saw in the times that I looked at the debate.
Yeah, neither Dewhurst nor Cruz mentioned Sam Houston's bed.
Not that I saw, although I wish Gromer had asked the question about Sam Houston's bed. Yeah, the Senate debate was last night, the last one before the election, the last one, period, I guess, for this
race. Might have a reunion tour, in 20 years.
Simon and Garfunkel. Yeah, they get along about as well as Simon and Garfunkel did, I think. David Dewhurst and Ted Cruz had
their
last...
Which one of them is Garfunkel? We'll find out on the 31st.
Yes, I think we don't know yet. Yes. They had the last debate last night. I think a lot of it was more or less what we expected. I thought it was actually, and I don't know what you guys thought. I mean, I assume you watched it. And people go, no, I don't know what you're talking about.
Debate?
You know what
they
say about assuming.
Jay's going to Rick Perry.
Sometimes
wasn't there. I don't
wrong.
Pay attention. I thought a couple of things about it. One, I think... If you're somebody watching this and you're paying attention, I thought you saw a pretty good presentation of the strengths and weaknesses of each candidate, which is not always true of these debates. So, the other thing then that one has to say is that this was, I would say, one of the best organized, thought through, and run debates I've seen
until you got to this trip
in Texas politics in recent years. I mean, it was very good. Brad Watson and Gromer Jeffers both did a great job. It was the four of them sitting around a table not much bigger than the one that our listeners can't see, but it's very comfortable yet intimate. And I
would
think
you move over a little bit.
What do you mean
the questions were were very smart. I think both Brad and Gromer sort of didn't let the candidates wander. I think Cruz came off as sharp and kind of aggressive. I think, though, that he has tried to modulate, his approach. He's been criticized early on in the early debates for being too aggressive and combative and almost, frankly, a little shrill, I think. I think he had that a little more under control last night. Dewhurst came off as, for better or for worse, somebody who probably was more versed in the legislative process and the policy issues. Of course, right now we know that's a mixed advantage. But, I was talking I've talked to a couple people in the last 24 hours who don't follow this a lot, and I just kind of said, so did you watch the debate? What'd you think? And the first thing said, I don't follow it much, but David Dewhurst is kind of awkward. And I think that's an impression that a lot of people have.
Newsflash.
Yeah. It still surprises people that don't follow it a lot. And you have to remember, yes, last night was probably the biggest audience that any of these guys have had, in a shared stage so far. And certainly the biggest audience Cruz had. So, my sense is that Cruz, having not made any major mistakes, I mean, some might say he was, he got caught a little on this, and this is part of the questioning being good on the border fence. He came out in favor of a fence across the entire border. And they said, well, how, do you have any idea how much that would cost? And he said, well, no, but it would be worth it because, and they said, well, as it turns out, we got an estimate on the fence and, it was, multi-billion dollars. And so.
Did he specify what kind of fence?
He did not say
chicken
chain
wire.
Link. Yeah.
Chain
so,
link.
So if I was him, I said, no, I'd build a cheaper fence, but he didn't do that. But, I mean, it was also a sign of where that race is that Dewhurst couldn't really jump on that by saying, see, this is, you know, an absurd idea. He said, basically, I'd build less fence, but there's not that much difference between us. So it really, I thought the debate was a very good portrayal of what this race has been about, what the candidates have been about, and where we are.
You know, I think the awkward factor is really accurate. And you know how...
You mean that debate?
Well, in that debate, but you know how
the Tribcast.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering.
A lot of times people
will
say,
I'll move my hand,
you know, they're different when you get them behind.
Comfortable yet intimate.
You know how sometimes people are very different in person than they are on TV?
Yeah.
David Dewhurst is not.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yes, that's actually
one
of, not that I hang out with him or anything, but
I thought that one of the best illustrations of the awkward factor was after the debate, and he went on WFAA. I don't know if this was today. I just saw it online. If it was today or last night
two years ago.
But he had Leppert with him.
Yeah, that was last night immediately after.
Okay, and they asked him, you know, how do you think the debate went? And he said, well, there are probably some things that I would like to clarify. And they go, well, you know, what would you like to clarify? And then he, like, didn't offer anything to clarify.
He probably wanted to clarify that Tom Leppert had just endorsed him.
Right? Yeah. And that was, I did kind of, you know, bury a little bit of the headline there or another.
Really? Because you
headline.
Really just spoke for like a second, and I'm surprised you had time to bury any leads at all.
What lead did
you just hear this like, buzzing? You hear buzzing in the room a minute ago?
I really
Jay?
Don't. No.
I thought I heard this. There's a cricket in here.
The big news sort of takeaway really from the debate ended up being this sort of Leppert endorsement that followed it.
Well, I think actually, I think what's interesting is that it wasn't. I mean, and that's an interesting, you know, and I would like a reporter or somebody to ask somebody in the Dewhurst campaign. We probably couldn't find out now until maybe you could find out, but not until afterwards. It was an odd decision for them to basically roll Leppert out immediately after the debate and have Leppert issue this endorsement. Now, I guess part of this was the assumption, well, people are paying attention, we'll layer it on afterwards. But, you know, it seems to me like you combined a free media hit with the debate in a way that kind of muddled the Leppert endorsement.
But it also might have stomped on some of the Dewhurst looked awkward.
I was just going to say, I think the theory was, I mean, but that does transmit low expectations.
Right, did they just anticipate that he would be awkward? I guess.
Do you think it was that bad that he, or?
What, his performance?
No, he's probably going to be awkward, so let's roll this out now just in case.
Well, that's what I'd like to know. I mean, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to speculate overly much, but we're left to speculate given that to me it's slightly odd timing to have, you know, Tom Leppert waiting in the wings and then kind of roll him out right after the debate.
Well, I guess if the debate goes good, it's like, hey, we had a great debate and Tom Leppert,
right.
You know, and
it's
it
gone so
bad,
well, Tom Leppert,
like,
decided to endorse us.
Forget about the bad debate, we got Tom Leppert.
Does Tom Leppert do anything for Dewhurst?
That's the other question.
I mean,
it's
very
too
little,
late,
I think.
Isn't it? Isn't
well,
it
I don't think.
Late?
No, no. I think it's.
All of Dallas has just been sitting there waiting.
No, I don't think it's too late. I mean, I think it actually makes sense that you have the debate and people start paying attention and you're airing ads and people are paying attention again. I think it does make sense to wait a little bit. But if you're going to wait because you think people are going to be paying attention, it seems like you'd wait just a little bit longer and get another hit out of it. But
they were in Dallas. People in Dallas were probably paying more attention, and those are probably the people who would be more apt to care about what Leppert says.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. That makes sense.
Can I talk about one weird moment I thought from the debate? And this one,
No, we cannot.
Well, we're trying to keep this a family podcast.
All appearances to the contrary notwithstanding. I have the final say, so I'm going to do it. Okay. This might just be because I've been watching The Newsroom, which I will admit is not a great show. But there was this one moment in the...
You should talk about that.
You want to talk about Newsroom? You just whispered into your mic. There was this one moment in the debate where Cruz really tried to nail Dewhurst down on saying, you said in the past that we don't have the best healthcare outcomes in this country. And Dewhurst was like, well, we don't. But it was this very much like, how can you possibly say that America's not the best? He was like, well, our infant mortality rates are like 34th in the world. I mean, how can you possibly say we have all the best healthcare outcomes in this country? It was a very strange moment, I thought.
Well, I think whenever they confront facts and policy head on, it gets a little weird. I mean,
that's why we try to not do that on this show. Let's move on. Brandy, you had a big series last week.
Yes.
What was it about? Prosecutorial misconduct.
That's true. That is a fact. So because of all the conversation surrounding the Michael Morton exoneration from last year, there's a lot of talk about the role of prosecutors and, you know, what constitutes misconduct and how often this happens. And so I thought it would be a good idea to try to get a more sort of fact-based sense of how often it does occur, what happens when errors are made in these cases, and what the consequences are for real people who are involved in these cases. And so what I did was got a database of all the 86 exonerations that happened in Texas from 1989 until 2011. And we went through each of the court rulings in those cases to try to determine which cases that were overturned involved a court ruling where the court said the prosecutors made a mistake here, and that mistake contributed to the wrong outcome. And so we found that there were 21 cases out of those 86, so almost 25%, where a prosecutor made an error in the case. And that could have been anything from withholding evidence to making a wrong, inappropriate argument at closing or opening arguments, or asking inappropriate questions during testimony. Any sort of error. But it had to be a prosecutor's error. We tried to rule out police errors in places where we could, because those are separate issue, although sometimes related. Anyway, so we found that there were 21 cases. In most of those cases, the error did contribute directly to the wrongful conviction. And in 17 of those 21 cases, the error was that the prosecutor withheld evidence. And that was the main issue in the Michael Morton case.
So is that, it's not error like, oh, you know, I dropped something accidentally. I mean, that's a deliberate.
You know, error becomes kind of a term of art and procedure and administrative legality, I think, in that.
Right. Well, and that sort of term is the whole question here. And it's the question in the Michael Morton case. And it's, you know, what we also found was that there were only three prosecutors during that time period who had ever faced any sort of public reprimand. And what it takes in order for there to be a public reprimand, and really even a private reprimand, and how many of those there have been we don't know about, is for there to be some sort of proof of intent, so that it's not just an error, because errors happen. Prosecutors are people just like anybody else. But it has to be an error where the prosecutor knew that he was doing something wrong and went ahead and did it anyway. And proving that, particularly in a case like most of these where the evidence that was suppressed is found so much later, proving the intent, you know, two decades down the road is a pretty difficult thing to do. And that's what's going to be sort of the challenge and the mission of this court of inquiry that's looking into whether or not Ken Anderson, who was a prosecutor in the Michael Morton case, should face criminal charges, is proving that he intended to withhold that evidence.
At the broader level, Brandy, what kind of response are you getting to this from the political system? I mean, what do you think is, you know, you've obviously done a lot of work on this. What do you think is the threshold where somebody will go, you know what, this has got to be fixed? You know, because really, I mean, the problem with proving intent is that, you know, we know that the incentive structure is there, frankly, for the prosecutors to hide evidence because they're rewarded professionally, basically, for convictions. So, you know, what do you think is the tipping point where people kind of go, oh, there's enough? You got a sense of that?
Yeah, I wish. I mean, there really isn't much of a sense from my perspective. I mean, what I know from what the, you know, Association of County and District Attorneys has told me is that they, you know, they're doing their own sort of study to look into it and see how many times these errors occur. And most of the prosecutors who I talked to said, okay, it happened in these cases, but look at the whole realm of cases. We try literally tens of thousands of cases every year, and this is just a fraction, a very small fraction. And so, you know, in these cases, it had big consequences. But in most of the cases, we don't, you know, who knows what happens? These are mistakes, and how often do they happen? And it's really, really hard to tell. Right. And so, you know, they're doing their own study because I think they are concerned about it. And I think their concern comes from the public perception standpoint because they're concerned about, well, A, politics. You know, DAs are elected, judges are elected, and they get elected based on wins. And if people in the system, people, if juries and voters don't have confidence in the system, then they're not going to get convictions, and it sort of has this cyclic circular effect for them. But, you know, they're, I think they're really concerned about the public perception part of it and wanting to do something to sort of address the question. So they're having their own study to look into.
I thought it was fascinating that a prosecutor in Williamson County lost his job over questions about how he handled cases, and that it, you know, you sort of sense in Texas and Williamson County being kind of a conservative county and embodying this, that the that voters sort of want prosecutors to hang people from the highest tree, and they don't really care all that much if there are problems that, you know, impact people who have been in jail. And yet, in this case, you know, how did that election play out? Because I didn't even really pay attention to it until he lost.
Well, I think that was a big wake-up call for a lot of people in the criminal justice system on both sides, because, you know, Bradley's role in the Morton case was that was the DNA that and resisting the testing. He didn't have much to do, or really anything to do with the, he had nothing to do with the original prosecution. And so, but there are all these questions that came afterward once Michael Morton was exonerated about what his role was. How, why did he resist the DNA testing, and how much did he contribute to this guy being in prison for even longer than he should have been? But I think what it comes down to, or one of the questions I have about looking at this case in particular and why it's had such an effect, is if you look at Michael Morton and you compare him to some of the other exonerees, and I think there's been a sense in Texas that, and probably in other places as well, but it's particularly here, that people are in jail because they did something wrong. It may not be what they're convicted of, but they, there's a reason they're there, because they're bad people.
They wouldn't be in that situation if it weren't for some sin that they've committed.
There's some, their usual suspect for some reason. But in Michael Morton's case, I mean, he looks like a CPA. He never had any sort of criminal history.
Yeah, he was sort of a good poster child for that.
Right. And what happened to him really could happen to anybody. And so when you start looking at it from that perspective, I think people...
And so is there anything that can really be done to change this, other beyond having more honest prosecutors? Or is it just one of those things that, you know, people should think about as they consider the, you know, limited, the fallibility of our criminal justice system?
I think what Michael Morton and what other folks in the criminal or in the defense bar are calling for is just more accountability for prosecutors, so that even, so that when they make mistakes, even if they are unintentional mistakes, there is some sort of repercussion for them, and that, you know, some sort of recognition that these errors lead to big consequences for people. And so there's talk about requiring open file policies so that suppressing evidence becomes a harder thing to do. And there's talk about increasing the amount of accountability from the state bar that they dole out, and increasing transparency so that there aren't quite so many private reprimands. And also shortening the statute of limitations, because right now, if someone, the statute of limitations on prosecutorial misconduct is only 4 years. And as these cases show, it takes many, much, much longer than 4 years. I mean, the nature of suppressed evidence is that it's hidden. And so uncovering it takes a long time.
That's a pretty clear remedy. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's something that's pretty concrete.
So we've solved it.
Well, I mean,
well, it's
a
go.
Start.
Just
I mean,
extend
it's the wedge.
The statute of limitations, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that. I mean, you know, when people say, well, you know, people should be better, more conscientious, like, you know, you have more time to investigate, and people would be more careful if they know.
It's also, yeah, and it's also something that, that, it's also something that prosecutors, you know, that you could sort of shame them, maybe shame them a little bit into supporting, because it's like, hey, why shouldn't you be more accountable? And that you want accountability right. Everywhere else, and that actually.
It's like, if, you know, The statute of limitations on murders doesn't expire if you secure a death penalty for someone.
Yeah, so for example, you could say, why not make prosecutorial misconduct statute of limitations proportional to the crime?
All right, it's time for the podcast to expire. So if you have questions or comments, you can email tribcast@texastribune.org. On behalf of Brandy, Jay, Jim, and our producer, Todd, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
We've come to complain to you for about 30 minutes.
The bitch cast.